Hi, I'm Tom Power. Welcome to Toy Harp, a podcast about bluegrass. This is the last episode of season two. Here from Nashville is my conversation with Allison Krauss.
I remember, you know, the first time I looked out in the audience and saw people singing words to our songs that only we had recorded. That was just a really crazy moment. Just never thought it'd end up being there. Never thought we'd hear back from Rounder. Yeah. Never thought we would hear from Rounder in the first place.
If this is your first time listening, you can hear full interviews with Jerry Douglas, Allison Brown, Bela Fleck, Larry Sparks, Jody Stecker, and so many more wherever you get your podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Later on.
This episode of Basic Folk is brought to you by Yamaha Guitars. Yamaha's acoustic guitar legacy began with the introduction of their steel string FG series in 1966. Recently, their flagship FG9 model has become a favorite amongst bluegrass musicians such as Trey Hensley. The Yamaha Custom Shop in Los Angeles has handcrafted custom guitars for artists, including Jake Eddy, Fred Kosak, and Jordan Tice. Visit YamahaGuitarDevelopment.com to learn more about Yamaha's high-end acoustics. Hi, and welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. It's Cindy Howes. I host this podcast, the very one that you're listening to. So nice to have you here today. This is a really cool episode of Basic Folk. I had this idea to have Don Landis and Aoife O'Donovan on the podcast together, because coincidentally, they have released super duper feminist records at the same time, like right within a week of each other. So I was like, let's do it. They were both game. I'm so pumped. Before we get into Aoife and Don, let's talk about us. What's going on with us? What is the relationship like? Are you signed up for our newsletter? That is the best way to stay in touch with your favorite folk podcast. You can find a link in the show notes to sign up for our monthly newsletter, or you can go to our website, basicfolk.com, let you know what's going on the podcast, recent guest, who's coming up, all of our special secret emotions that we share only for those who subscribe to the newsletter. Again, link in show notes or basicfolk.com. Are you following us on social media? We are on Instagram, Facebook, and listen, I even joined TikTok for you. That's how much I care about you. At Basic Folk Pod on those three platforms. If you're a super fan and you have not become a monthly contributor, well, you can, or give a one-time gift. There's a link in the show notes to do that. Or you can go to basicfolk.com. There's a donate, and then there's a store button. You can get a hand-knit Basic Folk beanie from my mom. All right, let's get to the show. Longtime friends Aoife O'Donovan and Don Landis both have new albums with strong feminist themes. So I wanted to interview them together to talk about women. Aoife's album, All My Friends, is specifically centered around Carrie Chapman Catt, a prominent leader in the suffragist movement, and her work in the fight for the 19th Amendment. Inspired by speeches and letters, one song, War Measure, is even based on a letter of support from Woodrow Wilson to Chapman Catt. This album also marks the biggest project Aoife has worked on with her husband, Eric Johnson, who conducts the Orlando Philharmonic and the Virginia Symphony Orchestra. It's also the first record she's released since becoming a mother. Of her daughter's song, she says she sings as a modern woman not wanting to leave the fight to the daughters of our daughters. Let's take a listen.
Here in the dark, everything that once was becomes a tiny spark. Looking back from the next century, what do they see? The names and the girls who laid the stones. Names long forgotten, never scribbled in the tomes. But they were strong and indestructible. Their hearts were full. Now the edifice of women's liberty, it is almost complete. Protected and serene, the rich women still are holding their malevolent scales, growing bolder in their treachery, selling for free. Cross the land and declare them quick to cry, saying don't trust them with the privilege, don't even try. We have every ready for the victory, we're sitting watch the country as it bleeds. Of course
Aoife O'Donovan with her new song, Daughters. Dawn Landis, also a mother, has a more broad focus with her new album, The Liberated Woman's Songbook. The album features songs from the 1971 songbook of the same title to inspire second-wave feminist, women's liberation movement, and modern feminism of the 1970s. The songs on Dawn's album span from 1830, Hard is the Fortune of All Womankind, to 1970, actually two songs from that year, There Was a Young Woman Who Swallowed a Lie, as well as Liberation Now. Those songs showcase how women of the past express political activism in the struggle for gender equality. Let's take a listen to this song that is particularly poignant. This is Dawn's 100 Years.
In 100 years, what a change will be made in politics, morals, religion, and trade. In leaders who teeter and tiptoe the line, things will improve in 100 years' time. Our laws then will be on compulsory rules. Our prisons converted to national schools. We'll laugh at temptation with all-knowing tears. That's how we will find it in 100 years.
Ooh, Dawn Landis on Basic Folk from her new album, The Liberated Woman's Songbook. Both Aoife and Dawn released their albums during Women's History Month, which leads to a discussion of what that means to each of them. We also talk about what is on their protest signs at the march, the Taylor Swift movie, gender stereotypes, and, of course, all the waves of feminism. When thinking about the 19th Amendment, we acknowledge that this only allowed white women to vote. That leads to talk of how suffragists and feminist protest songwriters like Meredith Tax contributed to and gleaned inspiration from the civil rights movement. Aoife and Dawn are legends. We start with what their internal dialogue was like at first when undertaking these ambitious and important projects, and end with Aoife putting Barbie on blast. All in all, this one's a winner, and enjoy it. It's Aoife O'Donovan and Dawn Landis on Basic Folk. Dawn Landis and Aoife O'Donovan, this is going to be so great. Ready to get into it?
Let's do it.
Ready.
Okay. Your internal dialogue at the precipice of these albums must have been like truly wild. And I feel like that probably happens with like each project where you're just like, I have 1,000 ideas and I want them all to come out at the same time. And I was kind of feeling this way when I was getting ready for this interview. But the themes are like a lot heavier on these records. So I have this quote from Aoife's track by track that she sent, and Don also sent a great track by track. Aoife says, "I sing from the perspective of the suffragist who marched and fought for my vote, and I also sing as a modern woman not wanting to leave the fight to the daughters of our daughters." That's about the song Daughters, which is like, I read that and I was like, whoa, amazing. Okay, how did you manage the weight and the excitement in creating All My Friends and the Liberated Woman Songbook?
I think for me, it's interesting to note that my record, and I don't know what the situation is for Don, but started as somebody asking me to write something like this. It didn't really come from me sitting, you know, at home thinking, what should I write next? How about some songs about the 19th Amendment? Like, I mean, in some ways that would have been almost harder. I think I would have been paying more attention to the weight, to sort of the gravity, to the heaviness, had I conceived of this as like, I'm going to make a concept record about the struggle that women faced then and how that pertains to the struggle that women are facing today. It was pretty different. It started as a commission from the Orlando Philharmonic to do a piece commemorating the 19th Amendment. So I was sort of working within this framework of, I had to write a 20 to 25 minute piece of music that somehow, whether through, you know, imagery that really would that I was going to put into it, or harmonic imagery, or it could have been anything. It could have been like a soundscape. I mean, many people write stuff that's inspired by this topic that there's no text, there's no lyrics. Once I kind of had that framework, I was like, all right, I'm going to write a sort of a song cycle. And first I thought, I'm going to write a song cycle about, each song is going to be a different song. There's going to be one about, like, you know, the beginnings of the suffragist movement from the 1800s, or maybe I'll do a Susan B. Anthony moment, or maybe I'll do a British suffragist and how, you know, and I'll do somebody in the 60s marching for something else. It ended up kind of coalescing into something a little bit more tight. And I ended up focusing most specifically on Carrie Chapman Catt and Woodrow Wilson and, you know, then trying to a little bit pour that into the modern day with Daughters specifically, but All My Friends, you know, it all kind of comes together that way. So that's, I think I wasn't really concerned about the heaviness because it wasn't my idea almost.
You're given an assignment and this is your extra credit.
Exactly.
Yeah. And for me, I actually almost got a commission, or somebody talked to me about a project working within an archive at Duke University. They have a feminist archive, the Sally Bingham Archive. And so they were like, look in there and maybe you can make something. And so I started looking around, and turns out the songbook that I gravitated to had been in my house for years, but it wasn't in their archive. And anyway, that commission didn't happen. But then by then I had already done all this research and fallen in love with the idea. And then it was like, I couldn't stop it from there because the seed had been planted and away we go, you know?
So I texted my mentor, Rosemary Welsh, about your new albums. Rosemary is a DJ at WYEP in Pittsburgh who's been working at the station since longer than all three of us have been alive. she wrote back, "Good to know younger women are picking up on this. We need a new wave of feminism." How do you each feel about the different waves of feminism, and what do you think feminism should look like in 2024?
Okay, well, my project is from a songbook from 1971, so it's specifically second wave feminism. But, you know, before this, I never took a gender studies class in college, this was an education for me learning all of this stuff. I do wonder if it's the third wave. I have thought that several times recently, but I don't know. I mean, with my project, I profile women activists starting from the 1700s to the 1970s. So it's a whole range of issues and topics, but each wave had its own color and character. I mean, I follow the Women's March emails, you know, and that feels like a movement to me. So I don't know. Aoife, what do you think?
I think I don't really pay too much attention to what's called what. Mm-hmm. I guess I kind of haven't really, like, to me that's, it just feels like words. I think that feminism, where I would like to see it go is to just be the common sense and sort of part of the, you know, when you have kids, I think especially, and Don has kids, we have kids about the same age, our daughters are only about 6 months apart, but you know, you watch your kids and you see what they're absorbing and the things that are just so natural to them. Like, you know, my daughter learning about this record or this project has sort of been like, what? Like, women couldn't vote, or, you know, Black people couldn't drink at the same water fountain, or, you know, all these things are just so shocking to little kids. It's such an affront to their own internal sense of justice that I feel that they're born with. I feel like as human beings, we are, you know, you come out and you want everything to be fair. Kids are so obsessed mm-hmm. with what's fair and what's not fair. And I think that nurturing that as opposed to stamping it out of them, it just feels like the way to get feminism to become more mainstream and more something that people just sort of say, yes, it's common sense. It is complete common sense that women would be considered equals to men because we're human beings. Like, it's just basic human rights. It's fair. Mm. I'm like, that's not fair. But I think you catch my drift in that, you know, I just love seeing the world through those eyes, the eyes of a 6-year-old, and watching her sort of, yeah, like stamp her foot or get mad or sort of say like, that doesn't make any sense. Why wouldn't, you know, why weren't women allowed to be doctors, or why weren't women allowed to do this and that? Mm-hmm.
Both albums were released during Women's History Month. By the time this episode comes out, both records will be out. What is each of your experiences with Women's History Month? Like, when did it start becoming important to you, and how do you feel about it now?
When did Women's History Month become called Women's History Month? Like, is that like, I feel like I only started learning about these things that were like Black History Month, I remember from childhood, sure. But Women's History Month, like, did that just get invented?
I mean,
let's look it up.
They've had the Year of the Woman. I like that documentary. National Women's Day, March 8th, has existed since, definitely the 70s. I'm not sure.
Okay.
Before that, but I wasn't aware of it until
1988 and 1994. Between those years, Congress passed additional resolutions requesting and authorizing the president to proclaim March of every year as Women's History Month.
Great. I feel like maybe in that case, I probably was aware of it, like in childhood, because, but 1994, I don't know. I was already kind of in middle school. I feel like it's something I remember.
Like, it's too late for those kids.
Well, no, not necessarily. But I think that it is important, obviously, to allocate more resources and more awareness for Women's History Month, the same way that it is for Black History Month. But I think for both of these months of the year, it should lead to a kind of continued conversation where we do need to be uplifting marginalized voices throughout the year, and just really being aware of the fact that while on paper, maybe, you know, we have taken immense strides forward, you know, since the 70s or since the time of the suffragists, but there's still a lot of work to be done.
Yeah.
So when Dawn, when you reached out to the family of Jerry Silverman, who originally compiled the 1971 book that the songs are from, the Liberated Woman Songbook, they gave full permission along with the charge, keep the flame high. Great. What role have female elders and allies played in the making of these projects?
For me, with this record, I just listened to a lot of folk songs, and I found it was really interesting. A lot of men had recorded them. Pete Seeger had recorded almost all of them, and his sister, Peggy Seeger, had recorded a lot of them. But it led me to some interesting women from the 60s folk world that I was unaware of previously. I mean, of course, I had always loved Joan Baez. And then I made a musical review with a script and different singers. And that part of it, I always have an elder involved. So because it really draws it all home to have a chronology of, you know, a timeline of activism. And then here's a person who was alive during that time, who was making music during that time and is still here. And that to me, like Alice Gerard and Peggy Seeger, they're in their 90s and they're still out there and they're still performing, they're still making music. And that has been such an inspiration. I didn't know that was possible before. And I'm so glad to have met them. I Zoomed with Peggy Seeger. It was the best day of my life. But, you know, it was like, oh my gosh, I want to be you, you know? Maybe I can be.
I love that.
Someday. It's possible, you know, when you see it. When you see it, it's just so powerful. So that was really important for me.
That's amazing. I didn't have any elders, that, you know, sort of mentors of sorts involved on this record specifically at any point. But in sort of a reverse, I felt that it was on me to sort of be the elder. Mm-hmm. and was so excited to bring in the San Francisco Girls Chorus, who are, you know, a group of teenage girls. And on this record, I feel that my voice, you know, now I'm in my 40s, 41 years old, like singing these songs with teenagers just felt like this really beautiful moment to sort of say, okay, like I want to be sharing this movement with that generation. And just musically and the sound of their voices, I feel is a big part of the record.
In thinking about these two projects, it's not just one song or like a handful of songs. These are full albums that loudly document women's liberation and the struggle to be free in America. So there are subtleties in some of the press, like these songs are just as timely today as they were yesterday, and other kind of ambiguous references to the struggle that women face today. And they're also more direct statements of being inspired by the overturn of Roe. This is kind of like a this versus that question. Like, what do you make of being kind of enigmatic in a situation like that? Like, what is your opinion of being more vague about how you're feeling about feminism and the state of the world currently versus being more direct?
I think that in the age of the internet, it's really difficult to have sort of slow, thoughtful, nuanced conversations about kind of anything. And that is very scary to me. I think that I tend to not be vague, but to sort of be more private than maybe I would be in real life online, just because I don't think it's a great format or environment for having an actual nuanced conversation. And I think a lot of these issues are very nuanced, and there's a lot. It's not as simple as saying this or that, or, you know, black or white. There are many shades. And I think for my record, which, you know, more specifically deals with the right to vote, which, you know, is a basic human right. I think that sort of like coming into the 21st century, having now lived for 8 years, or, you know, we're coming up on another general election, 2024, it's the third time that a former president's name is on the ballot. It just feels like a very odd time to be to be alive and sort of be saying, we're living in hard times, weird times, end times. You know, it's like, how long can we really say that for? Like, I feel like this is just something I've just sort of been thinking about lately, like since 2016, people were like, yeah, it's getting really bad. And it's sort of like, well, it's like, how are we still having those conversations 8 years later? And what can we do to finally say, okay, like, how can we move forward? And how are we going to listen to each other? Because clearly the way we've been doing it isn't working.
Yeah. And to speak to that, the word conversation stuck out to me, Aoife, because I haven't actually been able to have a lot of real conversations. And I think like yelling at each other in chats or whatever, that's not a conversation.
No.
But that's how I often hear opposing viewpoints, right? Or that's how I take them in usually, because nobody will say that to your face. But what I've thought about with my particular show is, you know, I want to be inclusive. I want to include men. I want the music and the show to appeal to men as well, because they can be allies and we need them. So you have to walk the line, you know, you have to think about that. I mean, you know, it's like Thanksgiving, it's like Thanksgiving when you're Midwestern and you have Northeastern sentiments. So
no, for sure. I think that's exactly it. It's like, and I don't know if you're from Kentucky, Don. So, I mean, you probably have a slightly different perspective, but I've talked a lot over the last couple of years about how different it is being from Massachusetts and growing up in Massachusetts and always sort of being surrounded by people who vote the exact same way. And, you know, you just sort of think the same thing. You don't, Thanksgiving is never an issue in my family.
Everyone's Irish Catholic and a Democrat.
But it's like, you know, and then you move to the South, and I live in Florida. And one of the things that I like so much about Florida is that people will talk slower. People will have a conversation and it doesn't get angry and doesn't get ugly. And you can sort of say, I disagree with you about that. And you can kind of talk and you can joke and you can actually try to listen to each other. And I think that that's like, because so much of the discourse is done online and through like media consumption, like a feedback loop of whatever media you already read, then you get more. It just feels like, gosh, that's what scares me for the future.
Hmm. Here's a quote from a man, Don's producer, Josh Kaufman, our bud. He says, many of these songs were already powerful in message, but musically, we were never meant to travel beyond the picket line. The songs were never meant to travel beyond the picket line. I hope our work helps to amplify their message of freedom and equity anew. So in turning these songs, speeches, and even some of the oratory that was incorporated verbatim, how hard was it to translate to your 2024 audience, musically speaking, without it coming off as like trite, preachy, or just like corny?
Well, I'll start first because Josh Kaufman is amazing, and I really worked with him. He's responsible for a lot of the musical sound of this project. But yeah, what he said is true. You know, a lot of these were protest songs. And with a protest song, it has to be super catchy and super repetitive so that people can learn it quickly. You know, I was thinking about it on my project. There's only one song about suffrage, and it used to be sung to the tune of Auld Lang Syne because everybody knew it, you know, so everybody could get the sheet of music and sing the song because they all knew the tune. So we changed the tune to that. So that part was really fun. And as far as lyrically, it kind of felt like translating sometimes from a different language if it was very old. And then sometimes it was fine with just a couple touches. Aoife, how was it for you?
It's very similar. So a lot of the songs on my record are just me, but there are a couple, two in particular. Actually three. Crisis, where Carrie Chapman Catt gave a speech called Crisis, where I just kind of tried to take her ideas and some of her words, but mostly rephrasing what she had said and sort of trying to make it be more like a kind of almost a bluegrass song. Like she obviously didn't start her speech by saying, gather around girls, let me tell you about the crisis that is here. But it was to that effect, but just not in that style of speech. But America Come, I think it's the seventh song on my record. It really is. A lot of those lines are directly from her. And some of those sentences, I didn't even feel that I had to change because the sentences themselves are so powerful. They're just like rock solid. Like the idea, what is this democracy for which the world is battling, for which we offer up our manpower, woman power, money power, our all. Like that sentence, when I first read that sentence, I was like, oh my God, like, yeah, what is it? Like, why, you have to ask yourself that, like when you are thinking about all of these things and for your project too, I'm sure, Don, like what is the thing that we are fighting for? And, you know, you have to kind of put a name on that and try to figure that out. Otherwise you're just sort of stumbling blind.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Okay. More on men. Speaking of Josh, one of the many men involved in both of your albums, Aoife, you worked with two male co-producers, including your husband, the conductor Eric Jacobson, which is cool. This is the first time you've been able to work together on a big project. That's awesome. What kind of feminist energy did these guys bring to the music? And what do you think they learned about feminism from this experience?
Well, I'll start just since you asked about Eric. I feel so lucky, and I know Dawn has worked with her husband a little bit too, maybe not on this project, but on other projects. And I feel so lucky to be married to somebody who respects women so much. And you know, my husband is the kind of guy who he works, you know, he's an artistic director at many orchestras, and all of the orchestras that he works with, he loves having women be the boss. He would much rather have a female executive director. Like many of his orchestras are just like all of the people that he works with are women. He works really well with women. He really respects women. I can't speak for him, but I would say he thinks they're probably a little bit smarter than men. and so having his energy on this record was great. He was obviously his knowledge of the classical world and just orchestral charts was really invaluable to me because there's no way that I would have been able to, you know, get the orchestra charts. And, you know, I was working with a great female arranger, orchestrator, Tanner Porter, but as she was sort of sending us stuff and I was sending her comments back and, you know, asking to change ideas and saying, well, I think that should be cellos. And Eric was like, well, actually it won't really work on cello because, you know, that register doesn't really work on cello, things like that. Like his musical knowledge was really complimentary, I think, to mine. What about you, Don?
Yes, my husband also likes being bossed around by women. No, I mean, as a teaching artist for, you know, in New York and stuff, he often had women as bosses, which is interesting. But no, he didn't collaborate with me on this. It was very interesting for me, this project, because we recorded it remotely. So I stayed in North Carolina and Josh stayed in, he stayed in upstate New York, because we both have really young children and neither one of us wanted to travel. And we had worked together for so long. We know each other really well musically. So I felt very comfortable. And, you know, look at, I mean, also he's been producing so many great records lately, and a lot of them have been women's albums and they're all wonderful. He just has this great, I mean, chemistry with musicians and writers, but I think especially with women, he works really well with them.
Hmm. I was reading up about Carrie Chapman Catt. Sorry, I knew I was going to screw that up. And so it sounds like she was married to her first husband, who was like he bought a newspaper, and basically they like ran it together. And he was like really into women's rights and suffragettes and everything. And just thinking about the men that needed to have that mentality, like they're out there, you know, and they're
of course, why we're here. And they always have been out there. And I think that's the thing that it's sort of, you know, they always have been out there, the men who really support women. And we should all be grateful for the fact that it hasn't, like, that they're, you know, the purveying, like the overarching idea of the time was like, no, but there were the people who said like, but yes.
Yeah.
Thank goodness.
The suffrage song that I sing, it's called Keep Woman in Her Sphere. And it was actually written by a man. It was written by a guy named Experience Estabrook. He was a lawyer. Yes. His name was Experience. That was his first name.
Wow. What's the nickname for that?
E. It's listed as E. Estabrook.
Got it.
But yeah, he was a lawyer, and yeah, and there's a couple other songs too in the songbook that were you know, written by men, or part of them were written by men, and I find that really interesting, especially when they can get it written so well. Like, how did they do that? You know, it's like when a good novelist can write a female character. It's like, what did they do?
How did Isabel Archer?
How did they get in there? How did they get in my head? You know, yeah. It's possible.
So like we were talking about, you're totally. Each married to musical men who work in different worlds. This is just a question about your husbands, not specifically about feminism. So Don's husband, Creighton Irons, is musical theater composer. Eric is the music director of the Orlando Philharmonic Orchestra. My Boston accent almost just came out there. Orlando. What is it like to have someone so close but so far away from what you do in music? And then how does it feel when you're able to professionally cross paths and collaborate?
I mean, I met Creighton because I wrote a musical, but that was sort of a fluke. Like, I didn't consider myself a musical theater writer until I suddenly was writing a musical, but he went to grad school for it. So he knew how to actually do it. And he had written many of them. And
wait, is your love story like A Star Is Born?
Yeah. We met, you know, the musical Annie. It was originated at a theater in Connecticut, and that's where we met. Anyway.
Beautiful. Like Little Orphan Annie?
No. Aoife, are you familiar with the musical Annie?
Well, I was like, the sun will come out.
Miss Hannigan. Yes. But I don't know. We play a lot of music together. But yeah, it is interesting. For me, I need my own space. I need to carve out my own space also. But we play a lot of music together. He plays keys in my band a lot of the time. And but no, I don't know. It's a balance. I think you need a little bit of both. You need a little bit of space and a little bit of togetherness. And too much, you know, of one or the other is you know, try to keep it in balance. What do you think, Aoife?
Yeah. I mean, I think for us, we really don't do that much music together. I think that, so it's tough because Eric has not just the Orlando Phil, he also is the conductor of the Virginia Symphony and the Knights, and does a lot of like guest conducting. So our lives are just kind of wonky. Like, you know, this week Eric was gone. He got back at 1 a.m. on Monday. I went to the airport at 5 a.m.
Oh, wow.
You know, 4 hours later. And so it just, like, there's a lot of that goes on in our lives. But it does, you know, it works, and we make it work, obviously. But it's so special when we do get to do stuff together and we get to play together. We're going to do a duo show in Virginia this summer, and he's going to conduct this whole record. We're doing a big show at the Barbican in London, and he's the conductor for that. So that'll be great.
That sounds so fun. I want to buy a plane ticket and get over there, but that's my wife's birthday.
It's going to be, well, you know what else is happening that week is Taylor Swift at Wembley. And we may or may not be going to that concert.
That's funny, because I'll play at the Barbican in September, and Creighton will also be music directing the band. So there you go.
Wow. I think I saw that.
Leave a little note for Dawn somewhere.
Yes, leave me a note.
So this might be a question that falls flat, but I'm going to try it. So Dawn's version of Which Side Are You On combines Florence Reese's lyrics from the song Which Side Are You On, along with Aunt Molly Jackson's I Am a Union Woman. And Dawn writes, there's no evidence that these two women ever crossed paths, yet they simultaneously wrote pro-union lyrics to the same melody, which is amazing. And the song your version of the song is so beautiful. For each of you, I don't know if this makes sense, but like, what reoccurring melodies did you see coming to the surface in both your projects, and how do you think they reflect the content and inspiration for the songs?
I have an answer for this. Reoccurring melodies. Well, I got the chance to listen to Aoife's album last night, and it was so beautiful. And I noticed before the last track, there's a hint of Battle Hymn of the Republic. Before the last track, and Battle Hymn of the Republic is a huge inspiration for my project and just for protest music in general. There's actually a wonderful article in The Atlantic about the history of that song.
Just read that. Yes. Yeah. I read that when I was working on this thing. It's an abolitionist song, and the text for that was written by a woman, and it's really incredible.
Yeah, it's incredible. And it's been repurposed for so many different movements throughout history. And in my show, it didn't make it on the album, but when I do a performance of this, at the end, everybody comes out and we sing Battle Hymn of Women. Which was, the lyrics were rewritten by Meredith Tax, but the melody was repurposed from the civil rights, the chorus was repurposed from the civil rights, because they say, move on over or we'll move on over you. But that was from the civil rights, but then Meredith Tax wrote lyrics on top of that with a feminist bent. Anyway, but the history of that song is fantastic, and I love it. I loved hearing that in your album, Aoife.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, and that song actually does come back in the arrangement of The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll that Gabe Kahane arranged, sort of as this very sort of dissonant undercurrent.
It's a mindfuck, Aoife.
Yeah, it's so that's all Gabe Kahane. And we actually wanted to take it out of the song, and I wanted to use it as an intro to the song because I just felt like I love the story of that song. I love how it is. The text was written by a woman. It's this anti-slavery song, and it just feels like, okay, that this may feel like it has nothing to do with the rest of the album, but it actually does.
Wow. Amazing. Whew. Wow. That was great. Glad I asked it. That was a good, really good time. This is the fun we're having. What did studying the words of these women from the past do to your appreciation with the way people used to write and speak?
People, I think, took more time back in the old days. They weren't as quick to let out, you know, a vomit of words as we are wont to do in the 2020s. I think that just reading the words and speeches from suffragists, you're sort of really focused on how they need to get their message across and the language that they're using and the tone that they're using. And I think there's a lot to be said for just absorbing that old fashioned language, but recognizing that obviously times have changed. So if Dawn or I were to write a song that was, you know, or start speaking in an old archaic way, it would be, you know, it would be ridiculous. But it is, you know, the English language is beautiful.
I've been reading Mark Twain's Joan of Arc, and I just finished up, this is a little bit different. I just finished up The Brothers Karamazov, which took forever. And then I have another classic book sitting next to me, but I'm just like really enjoying the what it does to your brain to read slow, beautiful sentences.
Well, I feel like, I mean, Brothers Karamazov, that's also like so much from that's the translator too, right? You know, it's like the...
Yes, totally.
So that's a whole other thing, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we had two different copies because my wife is like, we're going to read this together. And I was the one that ended up reading the whole thing. And my library book was renewed too many times. But hers, I was able to renew it. Sorry, this is a long story. But then I put back I gave back my translation and started reading hers. And it was like completely different and so much easier to read.
It's so funny because I feel like a lot of those Russian novels that, and you were talking about this, down like the translating of it was almost like translating from another language. It's really wild how you can even deal with that within English.
Yeah.
Within your own language.
Yes. When I worked on my musical a couple years ago, I had some Shakespeare translation. Like I made some songs from Shakespeare, and with the translations a few years ago, I did a musical called Row, and I had there were several moments where I took text that the character was reading and made it into music, and a couple of them were she was reading Shakespeare. So making that into a song and modernizing that was pretty good practice for this, I think.
Side note, has anybody read Hamnet?
I've heard it's amazing, but no, I haven't read it.
It's so good. Yeah. It's a really fun novel. It's like you could read it on one airplane ride. But it's great.
I just learned about Hamnet. I took a tour of Stratford upon Avon and they were talking about it,
Yes, you should get this book. It's a great, like put it on your list for your next. It's like a fun, that sounds dark because it's about like the kid dying, but it's obviously
it's a wild ride.
It's so fun. It's like really well written and really like meaty in a good way.
Cool. So on being mothers with these projects, whose quote is this? Oh, I think this is Aoife. Aoife said, "I thought about motherhood a lot more than on previous records. In fact, on the song Someone to Follow, you're encouraging your daughter to be a leader, to achieve greatness and be whole. You're both mothers to young girls. Dawn, you also have a son. What is it like to be a mother who encourages her daughter and possibly her son to be a fighter in 2024? And how will you teach her to fight?"
It's funny that I said I thought about this a lot more than on previous records, because the reality is I only made one other record since becoming a mother. So it's like I obviously wasn't thinking about motherhood when I was making any of the records I made before 2017. But I think that it is, it's little things. It's specifically on my record, the song Someone to Follow, which started out as me wanting to write a song from the perspective of the mother of a suffragist. I was sort of like, what were their mothers like? And that was my goal for that song. I was like, I want to write a suffragist's mother's song. But then I realized like it just kind of became equally about me singing to my own daughter the same way that maybe, you know, their mothers would have sung to them or not. You know, it's hard to know, like, were these women 100 years ago, 120 years ago, were they encouraged to fight? Were they encouraged? I mean, not all of them, certainly. But I think that it's, you know, trying to model behavior. People say that a lot with parenting. It's like, you know, model behavior, and some, you know, don't lose your temper. And, you know, if you want your kid to put on his shoes, just say, please put on your shoes, which by the way, doesn't work. but I think that for things like, you know, equal rights and respecting women, I do think that that is behavior you can model. You can expose your child to literature. You can constantly be, you know, reminding them that these things are important. And then, you know, Ivy Jo had a homework assignment where she had to, draw what she would do if she were president, and she drew a picture and she wrote, "If I were president, I would stand up for women." And I was just like, this is great, you know.
Yay.
Yeah,
just got it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What about you, Dawn?
I can't remember exactly the question, but I'm just going to tell you a story. Can you restate it, Cindy? I don't remember.
Yes. What's it like to be a mother who encourages her daughter to be a fighter in 2024, and how will you teach her to fight?
Well, yeah. I've dragged my daughter to a couple marches. Well, actually, the Women's March in D.C., I was pregnant with her. So she was there, my captive. But she came very willingly with me to another one about 2 years ago. And we were making signs, which is the fun part of going to a march. I said, "Callan, what are you going to put on your sign?" And I didn't offer any guidance. And she said, "I'm going to write, I dissent." because, and I was like, that was amazing because we had just read a book about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And
of course, that's amazing.
And I was like, this is the most perfect sign. So now in my wardrobe, I have several t-shirts that say I dissent on them just because I thought it was such a great idea. And her poster was really cute.
That is so awesome.
Oh.
That's the best.
So also, we have a lightning round coming up at the end of this episode where I do ask you what's on your protest sign. So just think about that. Even though it is the lightning round, I want good answers for that one. So in the song Crisis, Aoife sings, "And if we fail to act upon it, it might mean the chance has been lost and we will have to wait to win." So the suffragettes did feel like they would win, like even if they didn't win in that exact moment. And this makes me think of the tragic murder of Ella Mae Wiggins that Dawn covered one of her songs, The Mill Mother's Lament, and also portrayed her in the music video for Hard is the Fortune of All Womankind. Ella Mae Wiggins was murdered when she was 29 years old. She was shot during the Luray Mill strike. So, huge setback. What did this experience teach you about strife and setbacks in fighting for a cause?
Well, I'm just thinking about Ella Mae Wiggins because the Luray Mill textile mills are not very far from where I live. And so I actually went there and I went to her grave and I got to see the mills. And
Dawn, what year was that again? I can't remember.
1929.
Okay.
And she was a songwriter. Her songs were amazing. But standing on her grave, and I can't remember exactly what was on her tombstone. I think it was she died fighting for social justice or something along those lines. And I felt like it was worth it. Honestly, standing there on her grave and knowing and seeing her children's graves next to hers and knowing that they lost their mother when they were very young. I mean, I've seen pictures and it's devastating to see these pictures. I don't know.
Yeah, I read her Wikipedia page. She had 9 children. And
at 29, hold on.
Yeah, and she said 4 of them died during the night from whooping cough.
Yeah, because they didn't have enough wages to afford medication for the kids.
Yeah, so that's why she would ask the mill boss to please put her on during the day so she can take care of her children, and he refused. And I think that was like one of the reasons that she was fighting. But yeah, really inspirational figure. And I don't know, speechless about that one.
Yeah, her life is very remarkable. And the way that she's perceived by the town, I think, is really interesting too, because when you go to the mill, there's one of those historical markers outside, but it says 2 people died here on this day because of the labor strikes. And she's a controversial figure because she was also fighting for racial equality. So there was a lot going on with her. She's really, but it's controversial. They don't want to put her name on the sign, you know?
That's so wild.
Yeah.
I wonder if they would do it now.
No, this is very recent. I mean, yeah.
Damn.
I know.
Well, that kind of leads me to my next question. Like, in researching and preparing for these projects, where did you find Black, Asian, Native, and Latin women?
For my project, I mean, obviously there is a whole, you know, that was a big divide in the suffragist movement, was there were many prominent Black suffragists who fought tirelessly, but I feel like the people, Carrie Chapman Catt's kind of faction, knew that they were going to have to make compromises. So I think that's something that I thought a lot about, was like the compromises that we make, that they made to take the one step forward, knowing that there were still further to go. And I think Carrie Chapman Catt specifically fought later in her life for, fought in the civil rights, was an advocate for civil rights and for racial equality herself. But I think that my project, and I feel like I say this now in every interview, but it wasn't, you know, it's a snapshot. It's an album of folk songs that I wrote. It's my observations of like a specific thing. And it's any attempt that I could have made to sort of try to tell the whole story would just have failed. And I did not attempt to do that. That was not my goal.
And even though I was trying to tell a longer story, you know, with a longer chronology, with this, I tried to give myself some parameters because otherwise you're just, it's too open-ended. So my parameters were this particular songbook, and it doesn't have a lot of diversity in it. But I did consult a lot of other songbooks from the time period, and those did include Black and Brown voices. So, you know, in the review, in the musical show, you know, I do a song, there's a Sojourner Truth battle hymn that's Battle Hymn of the Republic, but with different lyrics that she used to sing. And Mahalia Jackson and Bernice Johnson Regan, like Freedom Singers, I include those voices in the show itself, but on the album, they're not, because they weren't in this particular book.
So for Aoife's song, America Come, in the write-up you wrote, something that really jumped out at me was her reference to politicians not stepping aside to make room for new blood. She asks, are you willing that those who take your place might blame you for not keeping pace? Which, whew, that feels very timely in 2024. Like it's also a reminder that we have been in struggle before. I got this from an article on the National Museum of American History. It was an article titled, Participating in America Means Constantly Striving for a More Perfect Union. How has this deep dive into these women's stories taught you about what perfection in America should look like?
Perfection. I mean, it's funny. I feel like that's something I think about so much is, you know, how we can't let perfect be the enemy of good. And I think that that's something that just feels like that needs to change. We need to be able to compromise and to be able to say, how can we, like, why is it that everything is now so down? It didn't used to be like that, even in recent times, down these weird party lines where you have like just ludicrous things happening in the Senate and in the House where people are voting and you're like, really? Did you use your brain when you voted that way? It's very confusing to me. I think that the younger politicians, I'm really excited about local politicians, more so than I think I ever have been in my life. I think now that I am a public school parent and I'm in a smaller city, I feel more connected to the local politics scene, I think, than I did when I lived in New York. And I think that that's a place that people really should be looking to get involved and looking to sort of have their worlds opened. Because I think that thinking about politics on just the national scale is ultimately counterproductive.
Yeah. And speaking to what you said early on and there, Aoife, about like being able to make mistakes, you know, raising a young kid, my daughter is very hard on herself and she doesn't like to fail. And I constantly am saying, it's okay to make mistakes. Adults make mistakes. I make mistakes every day. And I think that we need to allow each other that as human beings. And we need to allow our politicians that. We need to allow people to make mistakes. But on the flip side of that, you have to be able to apologize and stay when you're wrong. And that's a big problem right now.
Exactly. Could not agree more. Could not agree more.
On the role of folk music in the fight for liberty, Dawn, you shared, that's the thing about folk songs. You just keep singing them. Why do you think folk music is such a good vehicle for activism?
Well, I think partly because the early folk songs, a lot of them people couldn't read or write, right? So they had to be very memorable because they couldn't record them and they had to know them immediately. And so there's that like magic in them. And I think so that translates, you know, a lot of them were kids' songs that you learned when you were a kid, you know, or one of the ones on my album was There Was an Old Woman Who Swallowed a Fly. It's from that, you know? So everybody knows that. Everybody knows that melody. I don't know. There's just the simplicity in it. It's very simple and it's a kernel of truth that's just carried on for generations, I think. Aoife?
Wait, what song were you talking about? Because I didn't hear what song you said.
Oh, me? No, I said just
the song that everybody knows.
Oh, no, the one that was on one of my albums is based on There Was an Old Woman Who Swallowed a Fly. I mean, okay, there's also cool. Those millions of books. But yeah, I mean,
There Was an Old Lady Who Swallowed a Cello. We have that one. I think that folk songs, it's music for the people. And I think that that's why, you know, thinking about pro-union or pro-equality, it's like the definition of folk music is that it's for folk, mm-hmm. right? It's for the average person, the person that it can appeal to a big variety of people. And I think that that's one of the things that I love about folk music, and also that, you know, talking about making your music be inclusive and making everybody feel welcome at your shows. I believe that I want everybody to come to my concerts, whether they are voting on, you know, a different side than me or not, or whether they don't share my values. I still want to be able to provide a space where music and art can transcend those differences and hopefully open up people's minds to a different way of thinking and to, you know, have these conversations. And I think that ultimately that's what folk music, hopefully that's what it's going to be there for.
Don, the songs on your record are ordered chronologically, starting with the women's liberation movement that began during the Civil War. So like is it 1855, I think is the earliest one, and the latest one is 1970. The song 100 Years, what the fuck? That song was written in 1852, excuse me, mm-hmm. and the 19th Amendment was not passed until 68 years later in 1920. In our post-Roe America, where the right to abortion is no longer federally protected, what have you learned about working towards something that you may not see in your lifetime?
I love that you referenced this song on this question, because this song was originally called 100 Years Hence, and it was written by Fanny Gage, or Frances Gage. She was a playwright and a writer and an activist, and she hosted one of the first women's conventions in the United States in 1952. And actually, she invited Sojourner Truth to that convention, and that's where Sojourner Truth delivered her famous "Ain't I a Woman" speech. So it was a big deal. And it was in Ohio, of all places. But she wrote this song, and she wrote, I think about this song all the time. And I did have to translate this quite a bit, because I didn't want to use the word hence, because nobody says that anymore. So the whole rhyme scheme of the thing changed. But anyway, the premise is, and I think about this, you know, in 100 years, what a change will be made in politics, morals, religion, and trade. In leaders who teeter and tiptoe the line, things will be different in 100 years' time. And she wrote this in 1852. And the idea that, you know, there's one other line I think about all the time. Our prisons converted to national schools. I love that. There's so many great ideas. And I don't know, I share her optimism. And I don't think it's such a bad thing to dream like that. And in her lifetime, she fought for what I think of as very simple ideals, you know, the right to property and, you know, things like that. But she never saw anything go through that she fought for in her lifetime, but she still fought. And her words are being sung by me now. So you never know what's going to happen. You just got to try.
Yeah. That's amazing. It's inspiring.
Did y'all see that Instagram ad a couple years ago that was like, women will reach equality? And it was like 267 years. It was like Selma Hayek was in the Instagram. It was a PSA or something. That's what I was thinking.
I quit Instagram in 2021.
Oh, okay.
So good for you.
Anyways, check it out on YouTube, Aoife.
Okay, I'll check it out. Yeah, I think that it's like, it's really hard to think about what's going to happen with technology and how, you know, there like, obviously as things change for the better, I think there are some ways in which we are kind of constantly regressing it's changing. Like, I can't say that all change, you know, I'm not for all of it. You know, there's some, the tech stuff really freaks me out, but I don't want to think about what it's going to be like in 100 years time. I'm like, will we still be here? Although I am an optimist too, and I do share the optimism of that text that you were just sharing, Don. But it does feel like, wow, it's really hard to imagine. It's just hard to imagine, you know, you open up the news and it's like headlines like AI replacing jobs, and it's crazy.
Yeah.
Why can't they get AI to clean up the ocean?
I've seen that. I've seen people say that.
Where do you see it if you're not on Instagram?
Sometimes I lurk on Twitter.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah, it feels, it's a seldom. I seldom log in now that it's like not really anything, but I feel like I've been off it when I try to log on Instagram now, or like even just borrowed my manager's phone earlier today to look at it. I don't even know how it works anymore. I'm like, what is this? Like, I can't, it's because it's just changed too much. See, technology, it's changing
every day. So on devoting oneself to a cause where there are like so many troubles in the world, in fighting for the 19th Amendment, they were working against the backdrop of a war, a pandemic, poverty, and lack of access to education, but the movement never gave up the fight, which sounds pretty familiar for the now times. What did you learn about focusing on your own causes versus trying to fight for everything? Or like, did you learn that lesson at all? Like, can you fight too much?
I feel like I can't take too much credit for being on the ground, you know, fighting as an activist. I don't consider myself an activist. I consider myself, you know, a human being and a musician and a songwriter and trying to offer my, you know, spirit to the world as that of an artist. And I think that I'm so inspired by the people who are out there doing the really hard work and the nitty gritty and actually really fighting and taking these huge risks and organizing strikes. And I applaud those people, but I don't put myself in that category because that just would feel, that's not true for me.
Do you feel like All My Friends is like not an activist record?
It's funny. I don't, it is obviously because it's referencing this very specific time period that then it's highlighting activism, but I don't consider myself to be an activist, and I don't consider this record to be like overtly political. It feels just like common sense to me. It's like, okay, we didn't have the right to vote. That was so effed. How is it 2024? And we're still, you know, like my song Over the Finish Line that I sang with Anais Mitchell, talking about, you know, I started writing that song in June of 2020, like that idea for the chorus, and not even that melody, but just the idea of like, if I could change your mind, whose mind, if I could make something, like and it's about like, you know, what can you make to help move that needle? What can you offer as an artist? Like, is that's kind of all I feel like I can offer. And sometimes that feels so limiting. Mm. And so this record, while it like has an activist bent to it, I don't want to sort of take credit for being like, because there are a lot of musicians who are extremely vocal and who are much more, you know, out there with their activism, and that is amazing, but that's just not me. You know what I mean?
Is it uncomfortable to like put something out like that?
It's not uncomfortable. It's not uncomfortable necessarily. It's just like, I just think I'm a more sort of private person than that. And I don't, it's just not like my personality or something. It's not like, I'm not anti it or pro it. It's just, I just always try to be myself, you know? And so that's kind of all I can do. So that's why I'm like hesitant to sort of say, you know, yes, I'm an activist. I'm marching. I'm fighting. And I do a lot. I feel like I'm really involved in sort of on like a philanthropic level and on making phone calls and on being really involved in my community. And on, you know, I just got so excited. I'm going to the Planned Parenthood Gala of Southwest and Central Florida. I love being able to support my local chapter of Planned Parenthood, like little things like that. But these are all things that I don't even really talk about publicly that much because I feel like they're private. It's just sort of, that's just how I am, you know?
I also went to a Planned Parenthood event the other day. I went to a breakfast. They do it annually. Oops. I don't know. I don't know. I used to be more active in the activist community when I was younger, but I definitely feel like having kids limits that. It just limits your time away from your family. But I feel like the activism happens in the singing of the songs and the telling of the stories behind the songs and bringing light to the ideas, because that's what it is. You're just sharing ideas with people, and music is such a great medium for that. And I feel like I'm doing my part that way, and it's more, it means more that way. And it's more me.
That's,
you know,
that like makes me feel better. Cause sometimes I'm like, am I just being a fraud? Cause all I'm doing is singing these songs, but you are right. It is highlighting it. You're totally right.
You're bringing the rally to your concert, you know?
Totally.
Okay, friends, I wanted to leave time to talk about Barbie.
Ooh.
What do you think it got right? What did it get wrong? What do you think these women activists of the past would think of Barbie?
I mean,
I think that Barbie was like, you go first.
I mean, I loved the movie. I saw it twice in the movie theater. When I could not believe when I saw it, the America Ferrera monologue about being a woman, everybody applauded in the movie theater. I've never seen that happen ever. So I went back a second time to see if that happened again, and it did not happen the second time, and I was disappointed. But that feeling was incredible for people to applaud spontaneously in a movie theater. So I love that. I love what that did. And I love that I heard a story about someone bringing their, I don't know, 10-year-old son or something, and then the conversation that ensued in the back seat after the movie between him and his friend, you know, about what is patriarchy. And you know, the fact that the word patriarchy is in people's consciousness now because of that movie is really interesting. Mm-hmm. And I'm grateful for that. I think they got that right. And the song Around the Campfire. I love that song. I mean, I love that music video of that song is.
I wanna push you around.
So good.
I thought that Barbie, and this is maybe like an unpopular opinion, I thought that it was like a totally cute movie. I enjoyed it. I did not have any emotional reaction to it. I thought it was like a really fun, visually appealing, well-acted movie about a doll. And ultimately like an advertisement for capitalism and something that I'm just like, why the fuck are we applauding for? Like when people were like, that's the monologue by America Ferrera, I was like, she's a great actress. Like she totally delivered that. But the thematically, I would just, that's just like, it did not move me at all. I could not see past the idea that it was this like, and my daughter plays with Barbies. Like she owns 35 Barbies. Like I'm a pro Barbie. Like every time I go to Target, she's like, can I just get one more Barbie? And I'm like, no. And then sometimes I get it anyway. Like that's like, it's working for me. Like, you know, I'm buying more Barbies since the Barbie movie came out. But I feel like, in terms of like a movie like that, I was pretty shocked that it was being held up as some sort of high artistic expression, because I saw Poor Things recently and I felt like that was a real creative, beautifully wrought and performed like feminine experience that to me was just like, why is this being mentioned in the same breath as Barbie? There's my unpopular thought.
I mean, I know that thought, and a lot of my friends think that, but I can't get past the, like, you have to deliver something in a donut. Do you know what I mean? You have to deliver the kernel of truth in a very sugary donut. And there's just I think the patriarchy thing, you know, but the fact that, you know, Greta, and what's her last name? I'm sorry, I'm forgetting it.
Greta Gerwig.
Yes. Greta Gerwig and America Ferrera wrote that monologue together. I really love that. And just that it was so personal for them and that they were able to have complete carte blanche from the Mattel people. That's the donut. I don't know. They're putting good stuff in that donut.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're right. I think I just didn't like it being, I just don't like when people, like, it just didn't move mm-hmm. me.
I get it.
Did you see Poor Things?
I have not, but I'm sure I love Emma Stone. She's amazing.
It's really cool. It'll make you think awesome. A lot.
I'm excited to see it.
I got to see that one too. It's on my list. I think it's going to be interesting when these kids who saw Barbie in the movie theater in the summer, like, what is it going to be like 20 years from now when they're like in their 30s, hopefully taking over for us who are retiring
as we step aside to make room.
Should be retiring. Thank you very much. #retire.
Except for Dawn, who's going to be Peggy Seeger.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Listen, that's fine. All right. Dawn Landis and Aoife O'Donovan, are you ready for a feminist lightning round?
Oh, sure.
All right. Which historical, political, feminist folk singer is singing a duet with you?
You mean in my dreams?
Yes.
am I going to get this wrong?
I mean, Peggy Seeger for me. I don't know. What about you?
Joan Baez.
Okay. Who is your feminist fashion icon?
Chloe Sevigny is coming to mind. I don't know why.
Feminist fashion icon? I mean, gosh.
Oh, Gloria Steinem. Excuse me, scratch that. Gloria Steinem, 100%. And Florence Kennedy. Both of them together were so badass.
Yeah, like what counts as feminist? Can I say Taylor Swift?
Yes. All right. What is one thing a feminist cannot live without?
Coffee.
Wait, I missed the question. Sorry, it was like loading again. Can you tell me what was it?
What is one thing a feminist cannot live without? Aoife said coffee.
Sex?
All right. Okay, who is the most feminist TV dad?
God.
Danny Tanner?
Ooh, Danny Tanner. Good one. Full House.
Oh, yeah. I'm just thinking, like, the worst is Al Bundy. That's all I can think of.
Yeah.
He's like the anti-feminist dad.
Yeah. Or Homer Simpson. Okay, what is the most feminist spa treatment?
Something with your feet, like putting your feet in hot rocks or something like that. Or like with those little fish. I've never done it, but you know, the fish that eat your feet.
Yeah, the fish. The feet fish.
I feel like a scrub.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Good. All right, this is the last one. What does your sign say at the protest?
My sign in D.C. said, your silence is your consent, which I think was Plato, but it could have been somebody else.
What would mine say? Gosh, I'm having a hard time trying to think of what my sign has said in the past or what it would say. My mind is blank.
Don't you think it would be the what was the thing that I read that was like boom? It would be, what is the democracy for which the world is battling, for which we offer up manpower, woman power, money power, our all?
That's a great sign.
That's it. I'm gonna write it. People will be like, what is your sign say?
There's so many words.
There was a picture on,
that's great.
I think in your press, Aoife, that had like a suffragettes holding a sign that had just as many words on it. Like you have to.
Oh, yes. To, yes. Like, I mean, there were verbose time.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, Aoife and Don, I was so excited about doing this interview with you too. Thank you so much for agreeing to both be on, and hope you guys had fun too. I had a lot of fun.
Me too.
It was so great. Thank you so much, Cindy. Thanks, Don. You're amazing. I can't wait to listen to your record. And I'm sorry that I
didn't.
I
love your new album, Aoife. It is so beautiful.
Thank you. I can't wait to listen to yours.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by Anthony Cabrera. Our music composed by Alex Stanton. Basic Folk is on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. You can find all of our episodes there. You can search for Basic Folk on the SiriusXM app. Check us out on FolkAlley.com or on Folk Alley's mobile app. Our website is basicfolk.com, or you can listen wherever you get podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode, we suggest sharing it with a friend, like maybe your choir teacher from high school who was a super feminist and inspired you to also be a super badass feminist. And told you that the girl from the movie Election that turned out to be a lesbian reminded them a lot of you, even though you were like, I'm not gay, whatever, lady. And then come to find out, she was dead right. Anyways, send it to your old choir teacher from high school. I think she'll really enjoy it and be empowered and also be very proud of you. Okay. Hope you have a wonderful day, and thanks for listening all the way to the end. Fight the power, and we'll talk to you next time. Bye.